third voice tech person. Is that right? I will use that time to announce that the moot court will be on December 1st, 1999. You may have heard rumor that it was November 30th, 1999. You may have gotten that from our webpage. It turns out that's not true. It's on December 1st, 1999, in the evening. So please block out that time, especially if you are one of the litigators. But even if you'd like to sit in and listen, you should do that. And that will also be a joint MIT-HLS production. And I hope the MIT students who are part of it know who they are and are already working with the respective law student teams. Okay, are we still lacking our second MIT person?
She's being represented by her attorney.
She's being represented by her attorney. All right, lovely. Why don't we get started and do so by self-introducing our panel. So, who do we have here? You are, and I guess we should do the microphone game, shouldn't we?
Hi, I'm Bethany Glover, and I'm the role of the consumer.
You are the consumer. You have to be the role. Okay.
I'm Cynthia Ortega, and I'm an attorney for Compass Computers, and my client has been a victim of third voice.
And to avoid any possible similarity between companies in the real world, you'll notice that Compaq in 8-point type here is spelled with a C on the end rather than a Q. That's intentional. There's no relationship, of course, to the real Compaq. Yes.
My name is Daniel Boland, and I am the attorney for Third Voice.
Welcome.
My name is Patrick Kramer. I'm the webmaster for Compaq with a C.
And I see you've already editorialized. You've added a post-it note to your very name tag, just say no to third voice. That's wonderful. Okay. So let's figure out what the problem is exactly. And to understand the problem, first let's hear from the cyber utopians. Mr. Bullant, tell us quickly about third voice. And if you need us to visit a website, we may well be able to do that, either with the main screen or the trapezoidal screen over here.
Well, you can feel free to log on to
www.thirdvoice.com. Does our scribe feel up to that task? But do we have Matt on this one?
Yes.
Oh, great. Okay, we hope we do.
Third Voice is a web browser that allows users to add comments to the websites that they're visiting. And they can form groups so that their comments will be seen by a select group of people who often have common interests. Or they can make public comments. Or they can make annotations for their own use. The people at Third Voice believe this will be an excellent form for people to make comments about news or consumer products, and generally further the dissemination of information on the internet.
So this Third Voice site looks awfully like the Harvard Law School site. I see, we're just about to get to Third Voice. And I think if you ask for the demo, it actually shows you pretty nicely how it works. Now when you say make comments to the site, that means somebody could go to the Harvard Law School site and if they say, I want this comment to be seen by everybody, everybody who then visits the law school site also sees the comment?
That's not exactly accurate. You have to have the Third Voice plugin and you have to also be logged onto the site.
I see. So here is the example of paperbag.com, and there within it you see two circled red wedges. You would only see that if you had the Third Voice plugin. And you would only see it if somebody else with the Third Voice plugin had bothered to leave, like rat droppings, two red wedges in their trail, indicating that they have a comment of sorts to give. And I guess on the next, you see if you click on one of those red wedges, here is the act of clicking reduced to a picture. Suddenly, a pop-up note appears with the third party's comment on the site. Is that's how it works?
Yes.
And that's anything, anybody can get it, anybody can use it, and you're happy as a clam?
More or less, yes, that's right.
Okay, so Ms. Ortega, what is the problem with that?
Well, my client has been a victim of the Third Voice notes. My client has a web page And several very offending notes have been posted to my client's webpage. For example, one that says, it has been proven that the screen and compact computers can cause damages to the user's eyes, and in the long term may cause cancer due to the radiation emitted through the screen, which is not adequately controlled by compact computer screens.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So the compact screens are dangerous.
Well, no. That is a very false statement, and it is misleading to the public because it is not true and it has not scientifically been proven. There is another one that says, I can sell that same computer for half the price, and it gets an email address. And another one, Dell computers are cheaper and better than compact computers. This has caused a lot of...
It's funny, they don't have that on the demo. They just use paperbag.com.
Well, my client has suffered a lot of losses due to these postings, and we think that this is a trespass to my client's property, and it is a copyright infringement, and also it is a defamation to my client's position in front of the public.
Okay, so that sounds like a problem. I can see why post-its like that don't make you happy. And you want that not to happen on your site if you can help it. Is there anything you can do to stop it without having to resort to the courts?
There's nothing that we can do about it.
Is that right? Mr. Kramer, you earn your living as a techie for Compaq Incorporated. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. All right, so...
So if you just said no to her, you can't do anything about it?
Well, I mean, let's look at how the Third Voice software works. All right, so you've got that cute little like Third Voice window there with all the comments, right? And then there's that web page there with these little marks.
Right, those wedges.
Those wedges. Now, basically what happens is Third Voice adulterates the HTML that's already inherent on your page. So first of all, they're already messing with my design. I am an artiste. I take this very... I take severe offense to this. But let's also look at, I guess... she didn't want to go into some of the more offensive comments that we got, such as from Karen Tenderly.
Is Karen Tenderly here? No, apparently not. Okay.
Karen Tenderly, this site was ripped off from, or the back end for this site was ripped off from Dell.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there was also a comment from Hal Abelson.
What did Mr. Abelson say?
He said something about, I forget the exact words, and I don't think they really bear repeating in public. But it was But the point is, all of these accounts were created with Hotmail accounts. The way Third Voice used the security measure, security. Maybe I should like alternate my hands. The security measure used by Third Voice is that they make you specify an email address, and then they email you your password to log into Third Voice. So, you know, I was poking around. I created a few fake Hotmail accounts, and I started logging in as different users. And basically, all I had to do was log in as a different user on my browser, log in as a different Third Voice account, and therein I could easily post defamatory comments about my site or any other site. And since there is no verification by Third Voice, there's really no way to control who's posting the comments. So basically, any competitor could go and create 10 or 20 fake accounts and post a whole slew of false comments about my site.
Okay, so you've just added another bucket of tears to the sob story that Ms. Ortega started to tell about Third Voice. That wasn't entirely responsive to the question of, is there anything you can do to stop it? But before I ask you the question again, let me just hear from Mr. Boland. Here are these sob stories. Your desk must be rife with such complaints. Why don't you do anything about it?
Because these comments are protected. If they are desirous of seeking legal recourse, they have every right to try and attempt to do that in a court of law.
You're just telling them to sue you.
Well, they can attempt, but Third Voice itself is protected under Section 230 of the United States, Chapter 47 of the United States Code. And because, quite wisely in my opinion, the United States Congress wanted this sort of robust debate on the Internet. And
so you're happy to see lies about Compaq go up on their site thanks to your software?
I wouldn't say that we're happy to see lies, but what we allow for is for response in debate. So
he could put a sticky on his own site. It would be an answer sticky to the first sticky.
Sure. And to the extent that these comments are not credible, are not valid, they're going to be taken with a grain of salt. So it's like you hear any amount of unverified information. You take it for what it's worth, and I believe that web users are sharp enough to take these things into consideration when they read the comments about a particular product.
So, Ms. Glover, you're a consumer. Have you been sold on using Third Voice?
No, and I think a big part of the problem is what he alluded to is I don't think that the general consumer is intelligent enough to figure out whether or not these comments are accurate. And
that means you. You're the general consumer.
I'm representing the general.
You're doubting your own intelligence, so you're saying, don't subject me to confusing speech.
Well, I think there's a way to fix that. If you look around, and I spent a lot of time browsing different sites and looking at these comments, and it seems pretty clear that most of them are put up by 12-year-olds thinking, funny, ha-ha. The best debate of any sort of site or products or anything I've seen was on the Just Say No to Third Voice site itself, where there were lots and lots of postings.
So there's a Just Say No to Third Voice site.
Right.
Are you on our panel, or are you just contributing?
Yeah.
Oh, welcome. I'm glad you could make it. Please, introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm one of the software engineers, I guess, for Third Voice, and my name is Aisha Stroman. Actually, I think that since I just came in, you know, I probably missed some stuff, but it seems like everybody's just concentrating on consumer sites, and there are a lot of things that Third Voice is useful for. That, I mean, with any technology that you come up with, there's going to be a bad side to it. Email, you have spam, Usenet groups, you get on a bulletin board, and of course there's going to be some stuff about, like, I hate AOL bulletin boards. There's all this stuff about how AOL just sucks. That doesn't stop people from using it. I hate stuff about everything. This one just happens to be on the website. But also, I know I went to the MIT website, and there were three or four postings on the homepage, and one of them was asking about whether or not they could access theses on our homepage. There was something else about string theory. I mean, it actually encourages...
You could use Third Voice to encourage a robust debate about string theory.
You actually could if you wanted to. I mean, I was using my friend as a guinea pig to go through different sites and look, and he went to the MIT homepage, and he's like, wait, I don't agree with this. And then he wanted to email the guy and actually get a copy of his paper about his ideas versus about string theory and everything. And then I had another friend that wanted to do the same thing. I mean, I could put my thesis up and say, hey, can you give me some comments? And of course I'm going to get some idiots that say this is BS or whatever. But our Third Voice software allows people to vote and say, well, this is junk. And then you can screen out all the spam. So if enough people vote and say, well, this is stupid, then when I go to the site, if I don't want to see it, then I don't have to because it's going to be screened out as spam. Just like when you
So there's a voting ritual as well. People read comments and they vote down the ones they don't like. And as they vote them down, it makes it less likely that other people don't see the comments.
Only if they have it set to screen that way. But it's
allow other people to vote down comments for me.
No. You screen it to say, I don't want to see any of the comments that have been voted as spam. You can vote either spam or great. It's a little trash can or a star. And if it's higher voting for the trash can, then if you set your screening to say, I don't want to see any spam or any comments that have been voted as garbage, then you won't see it. But you can also set it to say that you want to see all of it, just like email. If I set my email to screen out spam, some good stuff is probably going to get taken out because
there might be some offers you want to respond
to. Yeah, there might be some offers, but if you set your filtering to get rid of it, then you're not going to see it.
So, Mr. Kramer, have you spent any time trashing the comments that trash you? Have you voted them as spam or unworthy on your site?
Oh, please, we have ethics here.
Please demonstrate them.
Yes, I admit, I actually have sat there and created the multiple accounts and voted down the comments. And I think that illustrates a huge problem with Third Voice. Basically, as a defensive mechanism, I have to create 10 or 20 false Hotmail accounts just so I can keep logging in to eliminate defamatory comments about my site.
So it's odd, but there is then something you can do about it. That's a way that you can prevent these comments from being seen by people who say, I don't want to see comments that other people trash. Am I getting it straight?
Yes, there is something I can do, but at the same time, it's shady. It's really not proper business practices, but at the same time, having people advertise porn sites or otherwise speaking ill about my company isn't professional either. I mean, Third Voice is basically a vehicle for unethical business practices.
Now, would you be willing to tag your page in a way that doesn't appear when the page is viewed, but that says to Third Voice, please don't allow post-its on this page? Would you be willing to go to that effort to put a little tag at the front that says, secret note to Third Voice, no post-its, please? Would you do that?
Well, it's like the frying pan and the fire. Basically, you're giving me two options here. I can either post it, I can put that little secret note, at which point any Third Voice user who sees my page is going to say, oh, this person can't have honest, independent comments on this page. At which point you're bringing the whole site and the integrity of my company into question. Or I can sit there and swallow the comments and have defamatory comments about my company and about my site.
So describe to me your ideal world. What's your ideal world?
Well, my ideal world would start that, quite frankly, I do think Third Voice does have some merit in its principle. But I think the first thing it needs is proper user verification.
So your ideal world would be one in which Third Voice doesn't let anybody post a note unless they can be verified as a real human being at a real address.
Real human being, real address, real identity, no multiple email accounts for a person.
Any other changes you'd like to make?
Any other changes? Yeah, I'd like to stop messing with my HTML.
Which means Third Voice should just go away.
No, I don't think Third Voice should go away. What I do think is that...
It's one of those wedges.
Yeah, well, I do think the wedges should disappear. But what I do think is, okay, if people want to use a third-party tool to assist them in surfing the web, because I agree there is a lot of garbage on the web, then Third Voice should first of all screen the comments that it receives, and it should check these comments.
But don't good comments mess with your HTML just as much as bad comments?
I'm saying no comments touch my HTML. I'm saying my HTML is sacred. My HTML is
so
what it is. You get to look at it. And if someone wants to use that side window, well, hey, that's their deal. I mean, for example, say there's a really bad joke that I put in one of the text blocks on the page. And people decide, oh, well, that was a really bad joke. Let me put it in. And all the comments are, yo, that's less funny than a your mama joke or something like that. I mean, that's really not appropriate. Moreover, just the user is basically letting them adult, like, mess with my HTML, I don't know what else is going on there, and the user doesn't either.
So, Ms. Ortega, I can now understand some of your frustration with your engineers when they tell you that there's nothing effective they can do about Third Voice. Mm-hmm. So what other tools do you have at your disposal to try to fight this speech that you don't like?
Well, we would try to sue Third Voice for three things. I think it should be considered as a trespass on the client's property. Also as a copyright infringement, because the notes should be considered as a derivative work. And My client has the right to enjoy its web page and has the copyright to its web page. So the notes are just a modification of this web page.
But why some Third Voice? Why not go after Mr. Abelson when he makes a bad comment?
Well, because the Third Voice is providing the means to put those notes on the web page.
So you'd sue megaphone manufacturers because they enable people to say scurrilous things loudly.
And also because, well, the people that are posting the notes, we cannot know about their identity.
Ah, you don't know who they are.
No.
All right, so Mr. Boland, you seem to be eager to have a lawsuit happen. Why are you so eager? She's just listed three claims, and of course any good lawsuit has three claims. So she's got three claims against you. Why are you so eager to have a lawsuit?
Because none of these claims could be brought against Third Voice. First of all, with regard to the trespass claim, Third Voice in no way trespasses on any proprietary systems of any computer servers. So it operates independently. So when you are downloading information on, if you're downloading a particular website and you're also logged on to Third Voice and you're downloading information, it's coming from two separate servers. It doesn't alter the content. With regard to defamatory material, the law is clear that under Section 230 of the U.S. Chapter 47 of the U.S. Code, distributors cannot be held liable for the content of the messages. Only the authors can.
This is the piece of the Communications Decency Act by which Matt Drudge may be guilty for what he says if it's defamatory, but America Online is not.
But
even though it carries this site.
Yes.
Huh. So you say you're immune from any defamation thanks to a law.
Mm-hmm.
There's no trespass.
Mm-hmm.
What about this derivative work thing?
We also do not agree that it's a derivative work, largely because the Third Voice operates not, it operates on top of the website itself. So it doesn't alter it any more than, say, Netscape alters the content.
Are you making a copy of the words in the website?
We are not making a copy of the website itself, only that portion which is highlighted, which is relevant to the comment.
Is that right? Let's just consult with the engineer. Not that I don't trust the lawyer. But that's what happens. We only copy a chunk of the site?
That's a good question. When I was, well, no, I've been through, you can see, well, okay. See, I have to use a quote, and I couldn't find the exact quote, so I'm going to have to partially quote. But Jonathan Zwitschrein said that Third Voice is more like laying a transparency over the web page. It's like if you put a transparency over the Mona Lisa and drew a mustache. But you're not
ignorant about this sort of thing. This guy has no idea how the site works, right? He's just talking about what it looks like functionally to a legal scholar.
As far as the site works, we don't copy it. I mean, it's, you know,
when I tune in to get the site, once I have the plugin, am I drawing the text of the site from the site itself or from a Third Voice server that is conveniently drawing the site's stuff in, adding the wedges, and sending it to me?
The Third Voice server.
It's so like, how does the Third Voice server do that without making a copy?
Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it. I mean, you could say it was a copy, but at the same
there's the original, and then there's, for lack of a better word, a copy.
Well, I'm trying to think of how to say it because, I mean, like, if I use my Netscape and I change all the default fonts like I have because I don't like the small little tiny font I can't see. So if I change all the fonts and I change all the color, all the standard colors, and then that's what appears on my default Netscape, is that a copy or is that a derivative work? Are they going to come sue me because I changed my Netscape stuff so that I ruined his artistic impression of the web page?
This is called argumentum ad disastrum. And it says that if what we do is a copy, then there's a whole bunch of other guilty people out there too, because copies happen all the time. That's what you're saying, right?
Exactly. That doesn't sound very good.
Mr. Bulland, I think before you embrace this lawsuit, you'd better get some expert witness training.
But I had a question, though. So, I mean, like, if I printed out the website, like I printed out these little Third Voice websites, and I write little comments all over it, and then I make copies of it, and I distribute it anonymously to the entire MIT campus with what I think about this person's website.
Uh-huh.
Does that mean Compaq is going to come after me and sue me for it?
Let's ask a lawyer. Let's ask Ms. Ortega. Ms. Ortega, would you go after her and sue her for it?
Well, yes, because it is altering my copyright, the property of my client, so we should sue it. You are making a modification. I mean, the definition of derivative work by the copyright law, it says a work consisting of editorial revisions, annotations, elaborations, or other modification which as a whole represent an original work of authorship is a derivative work. So
it sounds to me like the answer is yes, you'd be sued.
But if I make just a separate sheet and say, these are my comments about the Compaq site, and I distribute those, I'm okay.
I don't know. What do you think, Ms. Ortega? Did you go after her for that? For copyright infringement? If she writes up a bunch of stuff that says, I was looking at the Compaq site the other day, and I must say, my artistic inclinations are quite different from Mr. Kremer's. It's not a copy. So she won't see you for that.
So the problem with Third Voice is just the fact that we have it posted on your site so that when people come see it, then they can see what people think instead of having to go look for what people think. To me, it makes it easier for the consumer because instead of having to go look for a Usenet group that says why do people hate Compaq or what they don't like about the Compaq or Stereo versus Sony, I can go straight to the Compaq site and say, oh, look, here's a little thread about Compaq versus Sony, and I can read all about it while I'm on your site. And then I might actually decide that I would rather buy Compaq, because every time you come up with something, you say, if you look at everything negative, there's so much positive things, and all you want to do is concentrate on negative, so it makes your argument look good, but it doesn't. It makes you look bad, because you don't think about any of the good things. For all you know, every posting that comes up there could have been good. The only problem that you have is that there's some bad stuff. And free speech entitles us to say bad things. I mean, if we couldn't say bad things, that means every, as far as I'm concerned, every KKK site should be gone. Because, you know, I don't agree with it. I don't like it.
Well, if the KKK were to go to your site, copy it, and then add a bunch of stuff to it, if you could get them for copyright infringement, would you?
I don't know. No. Because, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, it's a... I guess copying my site and putting whatever they think, that's their opinion. And then I'll go and post some wonderful things about myself.
So I'll tell you what, why don't you kick it over to the lawyer who, if he were a real lawyer, would long ago have gagged you, sent you away and
we were not in a court of law.
Clearly not. Mr. Boland, how do you respond to the actual claim that says, look, you've been citing chapter and verse, you know, 47 U.S.C., blah, blah, blah. All right, so how about 17 U.S.C.? There's the copyright statute. You just had it read to you. It says if you make a copy, you are infringing. Haven't you made a copy?
No, we haven't made a copy.
Why not?
Because the only way in which, if you were to download a site without Third Voice, if you have Third Voice installed as a plugin, and you were to go surfing on the web, the data which you would receive would not be altered at all until you request from Third Voice the commentary about the site. So what happens then is when you go to the site, you will also get the commentary that Third Voice provides.
I
so it's not
heard
making
your engineers say that what Third Voice does is it pulls the data from the original site, whips in the comments, the little jimmies, the sprinkles of wedges, and then passes the cake on to the consumer. How is that not a copy?
I think that's not accurate.
I'm sorry. I referred to the white paper. Sorry about that.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so I'm going to read these. Basically, here's the way it works. The web browser downloads the page, this is like if it was from CNN. The web browser downloads the page from CNN server and displays it up for the user. Up until this point, the Third Voice client application has not been active. Second, the Third Voice client application begins communicating with the Third Voice server and tells the server which URL the reader is viewing. The Third Voice server looks up that URL in its data repository. If there are any notes applying to that page, the Third Voice server transmits them back to the Third Voice client application. Only notes in their position within the web page are stored on the Third Voice server. The actual web page itself is not replicated or cached by Third Voice. And third, the client application matches the list of notes to the text displayed by the web browser and inserts small graphical icons into the web page's HTML code. The web page is then redisplayed with the position of the notes clearly indicated.
So in other words, you want to amend what you said before to be the opposite.
That was a dialogue. Sorry about that.
Okay, so you've since changed your testimony. Alex here is drawing a chart designed to help us peel back the hood from Third Voice and figure out how it works. I assume Alex is going to parse the chart rather than me.
Sure, I'll parse it.
Okay.
Basically what the engineer just said is we've got CNN web server which has the HTML page. Normally with your web browser, this is all that would happen. You'd ask for the web page from CNN. CNN would switch you back to the web page. Your browser would display it. Adding a Third Voice browser client, what happens is the Third Voice browser client, once your web browser downloads the web page, goes to the Third Voice server and checks to see if there's for the URL. The URL would be something like www.cnn.com, maybe front page or module link store, whichever. looks at that URL to see if there are any notes attached. It then actually looks through the notes, grabs all the notes that are attached, and sends them back to the third-point portion of your browser, the plugin, or the ActiveX control, if we call them the Microsoft browser. And then what this plugin does is it goes through the text that the web browser has brought down from the web page and matches the notes to the reference point. So in Monica Lewinsky's story, it might be a gap dress and then a note. So it would match gap dress to the note that it brought down and display the new web page with the little tag and the other window here.
Is it the third voice plugin that causes this to appear?
What do you mean by this?
This being this thing, this page with a triangle in it.
It's the combination of the third voice plugin and the web browser. The third voice plugin is what causes the triangles and the page itself to appear.
All right, so now, and it's amazing to think that the outcome of a legal case on third voice should hinge on such details as these, then you can actually visualize the courtroom and this being what the judge is solemnly nodding at. We recall from last class, two classes ago for the MIT students, that a derivative work need not be a copy to be a derivative work. You can actually infringe one of the bundle of rights that is copyright by simply making the derivative work rather than by copying it. And thus was the picture that was placed in the ceramic tile deemed a derivative work. Thus was a cassette tape with a different story for the Teddy Ruxpin bear and inserted into the bear deemed a derivative work. And in fact, the tapes were burned as a result of the outcome of that case. So it sounds like actually Mr. Boland has refuted with his newly enlightened engineer, the idea that a copy is made, but how is this not a derivative work the way that Ms. Ortega has described it? Why isn't it something adulterated, as Mr. Kremer says, and therefore derivative to the original pure version?
Well, because it's no different than if you than the way in which Netscape alters the data it receives. It puts it in a certain format. So what, in essence, you're doing is you're looking at two things at the same time. You're looking at the data you're getting from Third Voice, and you're looking at
the
voice.
You're looking at the picture. You're looking at the tile.
Yeah.
You're looking at the bear. You're seeing the bear move.
But they're separate products. They're separate sources of information.
Mr. Kremer seems skeptical. You might want to hand him the mic, even though he's not on your side.
Okay, yeah, but Netscape, I'm really wondering how Netscape alters the data. I mean, what a web page really is a bunch of HTML. It's a bunch of stuff in these little triangle greater than less than sign brackets, and Netscape just displays it, or Netscape interprets it. Oh, we're going to view source? I mean, Netscape is just interpreting what's in those brackets. It's not modifying it or anything.
So this is your art. Behold, your aesthetic.
Yes. This is what a web page is. What you see in Netscape is an interpretation of a web page.
But I thought her point was that she can ask Netscape to do this, to do that, to do the other thing. I'd like to see it all in blue. I'd like to see it in
Netscape,
the aerial.
That just means Netscape interprets it differently.
Right, but isn't that a derivative work then?
In fact,
isn't what Netscape does a translation of this?
So you're telling me that if I'm colorblind and I see something red and green, that's a derivative work?
That's called argumentum ad absurdum. It often works, don't get me wrong. But no, what I'm saying is we have a statute, we read it, we try to apply it, and it seems to me that an argument can be made, this is your argument, you should be happy about this, that the way this stuff gets parsed creates something derivative to the original. It takes this exact speech in, it produces different speech out, namely the page for which this is the source, that's a derivative work.
I think we're missing the distinction between a web browser and a third party commenting and third voice.
Now, there's a reason why Mr. Kremer doesn't like the way I'm talking, even though the way I'm talking you would think is on his side. Here I'm taking so many things into derivative works. Surely what third voice does is a derivative work, and that helps him because he hates third voice. But the problem is, and what he's getting at, is that it proves too much. It's true that we now live in a world, forget derivative works with this argument about page source and page result, where these pages get copied all the time. In fact, your browser has this thing called cache, C-A-C-H-E, and with cache, you grab stuff off the web as you surf, and you stick it onto your hard drive. Remember that from Privacy Week, because what it means is somebody can come along later and see snapshots of what you were looking at. How can they do that? It's because copies are made. So every time you surf the web, you're making copies. You, either as the surfer, using Netscape or IE as your implement, or perhaps you can say the browser manufacturer is realizing that the way the browser works is by doing this caching. Now, Mr. Kremer doesn't like that because it makes everybody into a criminal. If we interpret that as against the copyright code, suddenly everybody is infringing copyright, and argumentum ad disastrum says that can't be so. Now, the way that I think we've resolved this so far is by simply not having anybody sue over something so silly, although we've come close because at times, for example, the way CNN counts how many hits they get is by how many people pull their page. And if you have an intermediary, say America Online, pull the page and store it on its server so that when people request it of AOL, AOL doesn't have to keep going back to CNN to get it. CNN is being robbed of page views. They're being robbed of traffic to their server that could be counted towards advertising revenues. So you've had instances, actually, in which this copying behavior done for technical efficiency reasons is not desired by the people who are so copied, and then they turn to lawyers and say, can we stop it? Ms. Glover, anything to add as the consumer?
Well, I wanted to go back a little bit to the voting application, which it depends on who you are, which way you would vote. So if you can set your browser to say, I don't want to see anything that's considered trash, well, who's voting on these things? So maybe someone with completely diametrically opposed views than I have. And I was looking at another application, and it was produced by Crit.org, and it's called Crit Suite, and it has a
Crit.org.
Yeah, it has similar commentary type software, and they have a means of their little brackets that show you what their comments are, different colors, and have different symbols inside of them. And so they will tell you whether or not it's supportive of the argument or the product, I guess. Takes issue with it, comment, question, and then third voice can implement something like that and add as well joke or funny comments, which is what pretty much every third voice thing.
But this is relying on self-labeling, right?
Right.
The person making the joke has to think it's funny.
Exactly.
And then say, this is a joke.
Exactly. But it would be easier for people to say whether or not they were supporting the argument or supporting the website or opposed to it.
But you're saying that as a consumer, what would help you would be some better visual cues about the nature of the post that you're about to see, either on the actual substance of it or maybe some kind of voting system where you tally votes of people like you.
Exactly. And
so
Third Voice already has a system where you can have a little group of people maybe you work with, people in the same field, friends, family, where you can only look at notes from those people. So that's one way of limiting the notes you're looking at to things that have meaning to you.
Gotcha. Are there questions for our panel? Yes, sir.
So I'm an entrepreneur trying to sell something to 50 Bows, actually, which is a little machine that they should sell.
Which consumers can buy and have in their home. And I'm going to write a newsletter that I'm going to mail to subscribers. And this newsletter comes with instructions for the machine. And what you do is you take this newsletter and you take your latest piece of compact literature that you got from the sales representatives or direct mail, and you're going to put them both in the machine. And the machine's going to cut up the literature and cut up my newsletter according to these instructions and attach these post-its.
Have you already raised money for this idea?
I'm trying.
People have actually invested in this idea? Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And I'm going to mail those newsletters out in commentary to anyone who likes to do this and can do it in their own home on their own little machine that they own with their own copy of the newsletter. and have a commented version of the compact sales literature. Do you have a problem with that? Is that a derivative work? Have I done something wrong, or is the consumer who actually applies it doing a problem? Or is there a problem?
Ms. Ortega, is that question enough clear to answer?
I think it's a derivative work if you have not asked for permission from Compaq to use their...
For me or for the consumer?
No, for you. For you.
What have I done? I've written a newsletter and I've made a machine.
But you've used the policies of Compaq also?
The newsletter refers to this Compaq stuff, but it doesn't change the Compaq literature itself.
So this raises an interesting point, which is, do you blame the person that makes the tool, or do you blame the person that uses the tool to the undesired end? And of course, the lawyer's answer is yes. You go after everyone, preferably the deep pockets. The way that turned out in the Sony case, the case in which the powers that be saw and beheld VCRs and said, my God, it's over. They can copy stuff off TV. Now, to be sure, we were giving it away. It was there for the taking by anybody who tuned in. Sounds like a website, doesn't it? But now they're able to copy it and store it at home and play it back whenever they want, and they can fast forward through the ads. And in fact, they can share it around, and when people tune into it, we won't get the Nielsens realizing that people are tuning into it, so our advertisers will undercount the number of views of our programs. Sounds like caching, doesn't it? And they said, as a result, the VCR should not exist. And in fact, the VCR's primary and only use is to infringe copyright, and therefore it should be destroyed and impounded and put wherever the tapes for Teddy went, and we shouldn't have it. Supreme Court, by one vote, decides that because the VCR has substantial non-infringing uses, playing back your own bar mitzvah tapes, time shifting, which they decide is a legitimate activity by the American public, which can't get home in time for their favorite shows, those are legitimate activities if done by the public, and as a result, this is an implement that is neutral, that can be used either for good or for evil, and we cannot put it away. The pregnant negative of the decision is, come up with an implement whose only or primary use is in fact infringement, and you might well be able to outlaw the implement as well as its use. And indeed, in the Audio Home Recording Act, you see an attempt by Congress to legislate the way the implements come about, to simply say there are certain uses that we're not going to allow. Okay, any other short questions for the panel before we move on? We should keep on a good schedule. Gavin.
Is this at all analogous to the situation where people have gotten in trouble for framing somebody else's website inside their own? There was some news feed sites that got in trouble for incorporating other newspapers or other, like CNN news stories, in their own frame with commentary and allegedly making it look like their own.
Yeah, as we jump here to TotalNews.com, two guys in a garage in Arizona got the brilliant idea of making a website. Have we talked about this site yet before? We haven't, so you're about to hear quickly about it. Total News says, we're going to make a row of buttons along the right side to people's favorite sites, things like CBS, ABC, NandoNet. You click on NandoNet, everybody's favorite, and look what appears, NandoNet. I know since moves, the guys in Arizona haven't updated their buttons recently, but here it is. Now, if you were to go to nandotimes.com, you would see just that which is flickering in the middle, and that would be your whole web page. Notice that Total News stays here and puts a banner ad at the bottom. So what is Total News doing? It's simply selling ad space on the basis of people visiting it for clicks, piggybacking off the content that it simply gets elsewhere on the net. There was a lawsuit over this by some of the other things listed along the right, including CNN Interactive. If you click on CNN Interactive, you will see the fruits of the settlement of that lawsuit, which is that it opens in a new window. Nando didn't get the benefit of it because they didn't join as plaintiffs. CNN did, so they appear in a new window. And we'll never know if the court would have said that the mere act of framing, of setting up an HTML window such that your ad is at the bottom and some other site to which you then link is in the middle, is itself a violation of copyright. And indeed, the lead argument by the lawyers was not one of copyright infringement. The lawyer who did the case told me that that was because he was bored of copyright cases, so instead he brought a misappropriation of value case under New York State tort law, the only state that really has any misappropriation law to speak of. You can tell he did not expect this case to go to trial. He got what he wanted from the guys from Arizona, and the guys from Arizona hopefully are not so lazy that they're not cashing their checks. Okay, so is that like this? Yeah, it relates. It has to do with the fact that the net is a technical environment in which you can go from one place, add your own stuff, and make another. Of course, interestingly, Mr. Kremer in his tirade said that this sort of thing would be okay. If you frame his site without adulterating it, but put the commentary along the left with the buttons, you know, you could have buttons like people who like compact, people who hate compact, danger warnings about compact screens, and you'd have that along the right, just like CNN and Mando, and then display where the banner is, the thing, that wouldn't bother you, huh, Mr. Kremer?
Well, yes, it would bother me, but I wouldn't be as almost offended by the mechanism used.
Because your stuff isn't getting adulterated in the same way. It's merely getting framed.
Yeah, additionally, it's sort of a different representation as opposed to just sliding these shady little comments in the middle of a web page.
Yeah, the question that I actually asked Mr. Keller, who was bringing the Total News lawsuit, was, if I were to make a monitor, as they log on to sites. He said he would get back to me on that one. It's a hypothetical, and he wasn't interested in engaging it. So any last words from our panelists before we move on?
Just say no.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. What's that? Okay. All right, so why don't we cut to our lecture component of this, which I will plow through in even faster than usual pace to make sure we leave enough time for Professor Sweeney. Okay, so let's start out from basics. There exists unwanted speech. Unwanted by a given private entity, Mr. Kremer, Ms. Ortega, don't like the fact that the speech is out there, or unwanted by the government. And maybe that's because the government doesn't like certain kinds of speech, call it anti-government speech, or representing collective preference of some kind. The government says, we have nothing personal about pornography, it doesn't threaten the republic or the system of government that keeps us, the government, wealthy, but the public seems to hate it, so they pass laws, we affirm them, and therefore we are going to declare ourselves as not wanting this kind of speech. Okay, how do you then restrict the speech that you don't want or that you don't like? One way to do it, I'm calling by norm. What does that mean? All right, well, we start off, there exists unwanted speech, unwanted by those entities. And then if you ask the question, how readily can one speak anonymously, a question that we have asked already and that we are starting to realize has different answers depending on what the engineers happen to build, you could see norm having a big effect on speech. If I am allowed to go onto the web and say terrible things about Compaq or about the president or about anything and not have to sign my name to it, I don't have to deal with the normative pressure of people hating what I say. Indeed, in this very classroom, if we have a remote comment system and you structure it so that you can make your comments anonymously, then you might be willing to say things that you otherwise wouldn't, and not just because you fear a bad grade or something for saying something bad, but because you fear the hisses that could emerge from your fellow students. Indeed, some of the feedback memos from the day we talked about the Nuremberg files evinced discomfort with expressing certain views because of that atmosphere. That is, for better or worse, the power of norm at work, for which anonymity is one clamp. In turn, anonymity can be driven by the architecture. How readily can unusual speech be seen? Ms. Glover talked about her desire to only see that stuff that people like her thinks she should see, which is to say, if people like her all vote to trash something 5 times before she gets to it, she'd rather not be cursed with it. So you could see architectures that enable people to not see stuff they don't think they're going to want to see. There's an architecture called PIX that we're going to look at in the penultimate session of this class, designed to do exactly that. And of course, much of what Andrew Shapiro is worried about in his street corners in cyberspace is this. There are people who, if they don't have to go by the common where there are those protesters every day, won't. And Cass Sunstein says that's a big worry. Right, another way to restrict speech is just through market forces. Here we go again. We know we don't want the speech. And then you ask the question, can the unpleasant speaker or helper, in other words, third voice or some other company that is the platform by which or through which the speaker talks, be bought out? Maybe Compaq could simply buy third voice and then consign its stuff to the trash heap, or come out with Compaq third voice, which does enable exactly what third voice does, but it just so happens not to work on the Compaq site. That is not an altogether unthinkable thing. Can it be taxed out? Now, taxes usually you think of as coming from the government, but you might think of other ways in which you could somehow make it more expensive to do the kind of speech you want to do. Indeed, you could imagine some internet service providers saying, you know, it's just not worth the hassle to host this very unpopular site unless you pay us a surcharge called the unpopular surcharge. And that will pay for the extra operators we keep on duty to handle the outraged calls we get from the existence of your site. Drowned out. Drowned out might mean if you make enough other speech that's different, can't you prevent the speech you don't like from being heard as much? Indeed, in Rusty Sullivan, we saw the government adopting this way of having affirmative duties upon doctors to say one thing because they didn't like the other thing that doctors might say. And boycott it out. Boycott it out might be, you could imagine Compaq saying, if we find out that you have been using third voice and said a bad thing about us, we will not sell you a Compaq computer ever again. And indeed, we actually have a consortium with all the other top computer makers. No one will sell you a computer if you act this way. Now, that seems an odd thing to do, particularly because it's hard to identify the people, as the current version of Third Voice says. But there are actually technical means of organizing boycotts of people who aren't liked for one reason or the other, perhaps because of their speech on the web. One such example is the real-time spam black hole list run by a guy named Paul Vixie, who sees to it that if you are a spammer, i.e., you say something he doesn't like in a way he doesn't like, he adds you to his Santa doesn't like you list, which is a very popular list subscribed to by the likes of Harvard Law School, and I don't think MIT actually subscribes. It does not, emphatically does not. But Harvard Law School subscribes to the list, and what it means is that anybody Santa doesn't like, Harvard Law School doesn't like, and no mail will get to Harvard Law School from somebody on the bad list. So that is a private boycott that can restrict speech, and it's a private bottom-up market force, one we will be looking at on the Private Armies Day jointly in a couple weeks. Okay, so those are more kind of broad ways of controlling speech, or speech that gets controlled through changes to the technical architecture, which can happen glacially, though it can still happen. Another way to imagine restricting speech you don't like is by controlling your property. If there's some way your property can be controlled to limit the speech, maybe you'll do it. That's why I say property and in parentheses afterwards, tech. So for example, a private entity can take certain steps to block the speech. In the case of Third Voice, though Mr. Kremer didn't mention it because it's not a very palatable option, you could design your entire page as a graphic instead of as a series of texts. And the graphic would be very difficult to insert a wedge into, because it's just one united block of graphic. And that would be a way to stop those wedges from appearing that he hates. If Kremer had done it as a graphic block, all those wedges would just be at the end as a little afterthought. So that would be a technical thing you could do to your property to stop the speech happening the way you want. The other example, well, at least realize, too, that the scope of the right is cabined by what? What is it that limits what you can do with your property to stop this kind of thing? And the answer is we're not so sure. In the case of Intel v. Hamidi, Intel started, I don't know how many people are familiar with Intel v. Hamidi. Some of you got it out of the assignment despite the missing links in the thing. Others at MIT didn't get the assignment at all. Intel v. Hamidi has the guy, Mr. Hamidi, who sends a bunch of emails to former colleagues at Intel telling them how bad Intel is. And he says, by the way, if you don't like my regular newsletter on Intel's crimes, just email me and I'll take you off the list. And there were people who didn't so email him, so he kept emailing them. Intel, the company, said, stop that. We speak on behalf of all the employees. Please don't do that anymore. He ignored them, and then they came up with technical means. They talked to their Mr. Kremer or their engineer and said, please find a way to block email coming from Hamidi. They did. Hamidi gets another email account, goes around it. So you get some kind of private arms race going on for which property is the tool used to restrict or expand the speech. The government yet hasn't figured out in what ways that kind of behavior should be cabined, if at all. We leave it to Mr. Kremer to be as creative as he can with his own page, and good luck to him, just as we leave it to Third Voice to be as creative as they can in getting around it. In the government case, how does the government deal with that when it's controlling its property? I suppose in the electronic instance, it means that it builds a firewall. It literally says we have certain government systems that are off limits. We just take them off limits, and that's that, and the public can't see them and can't speak on them. So, there you go. All right, restricting speech by calling upon legal rights. Ms. Ortega, finding the first method that was just described, that of technical control of property, not up to snuff, invoked legal rights to stop the behavior of Third Voice. And in that case, you might have a claim that the speech infringes some right, and you invoke a speech tort. What's a speech tort? Something like defamation. This speech defames me. That's the tool by which she could go after whoever she might find that's actually making the comments through Third Voice. That person does not have Section 230 of 47 U.S.C. to defend with. 47 U.S.C. 230 does not say anybody can say whatever they want. It just says the intermediary, the middleman, shall not be deemed the speaker when all the middleman is doing is carrying someone else's speech. So that someone else may be on the hook for defamation. Then Ms. Ortega says, yeah, but I can't find them because they're anonymous. I want to go after Third Voice instead as the intermediary, and Third Voice shoots back. The lawyer apparently was called to trial, but the lawyer shoots back with CDA 230. And indeed, you then see how the scope of the right that Ms. Ortega can invoke, the defamation, right against defamation, is one that's cabined either by explicit policy, a statute like 47 U.S.C. 230, that's what aces out Third Voice as a defendant, perhaps, and maybe by the Constitution. Even if she can find the person that actually wrote that nasty comment that hurts her sales, that comment about those dangerous compact screens, even if she finds that person and the state court is willing to award damages for defamation, the U.S. Constitution, in this case, in this country, may have something to say about it. Thus was New York Times v. Sullivan happening. Private case, two private actors, state defamation law, and then the Constitution was said to restrict, put a ceiling on what state defamation law could do. Now, if the government doesn't like certain speech and it wants to call upon legal rights, it simply makes a law against it. Passes a law that says, on the internet, you're not allowed to do certain kinds of images that children might see. Okay, it can make that law, but again, that too gets cabined by the Constitution. Somehow it has to pass the First Amendment, just as even private defamation invoked by private parties has to pass First Amendment muster as well. Okay, restricting speech by controlling property, parentheses, law. Before we were talking about property just as a matter of technology, as a matter of force, of what you can do. Now we're talking about property the way that law defines property. How does that work? Well, you can think of three ways it works from the private entity. First, you can say it infringes on intellectual property. The speech that they're doing somehow contravenes my rights under copyright. And what does copyright do but create a pseudo-property, a new kind of property called intellectual property, for which it's a subset. And you can say, all right, it's a derivative work, and that's why you're not allowed to do it. It has nothing to do with defamation. Forget the defamation stuff. I don't care what it says. I only care that it is an exact copy or derivative of whatever it was I said. So that's how you're using property law to try to restrict the speech you don't want. It's exactly the strategy that we saw Ms. Ortega adopting most enthusiastically, and to be sure, the one that might be most likely to succeed. There's another way to try to use property, entirely different from intellectual property, and that's the claim that the speech takes place on private property. And what does that mean? It means that if somebody comes into your house, even if they don't copy something of yours, if they start saying things you don't like, you have the right to throw them out because they're on your property. You say, get out, and then the police come and take them away. And when you say, well, what is that scope of right cabined by? In both of these instances, it's very unclear. There have been very few cases that have actually tested the reach of copyright law against the First Amendment, saying, might it be harmful to First Amendment values to enforce copyright? And there are also very few cases in which you have a private entity throwing somebody off their private property on the basis of what they say. It's hard for the person throwing out to somehow invoke the First Amendment. It's very unclear how that would work. Now, the government can try to do the same thing, but in the case of intellectual property, the government doesn't claim intellectual property. As a matter of policy, at least the U.S. government says, we are not asserting any interest, say, in our laws. So you can copy them as much as you want, you can deface them, you can even make derivative laws if you like, although they might not have the same binding effect. Go to town. If government were to try to assert intellectual property in it, clearly there'd be a constitutional fight. Somebody would say, how dare government do that? You can't stop me from copying the law. I have a First Amendment right, a due process right to do that. So you'd have a fight over it. Now the other way of doing it, the, hey, this is on private property, get out, is from the government's point of view just saying, when you are on public property, namely the government's property, we want to throw you out if we don't like what you're saying. That too has to pass First Amendment standards. And thus you have a ton of cases defining when the government can and can't throw people off its property for doing certain kinds of protests. Okay, so in the hypothetical case we have here, Compaq v. Third Voice, how does a Third Voice victim counter speech it doesn't like? And we've already come up with some answers. It tries the technical route, and ultimately it tries the rights route. And the defamation thing may not go very far, but okay, we'll use the intellectual property route to do that. The other route you might think of taking is maybe one of negligence or something. You could say somehow by refusing to collect identifying information of people so that they can't be reached by a libel suit when they libel, you are being negligent. And maybe somehow that's apart from the stuff that CDA 230 covers. I haven't seen anybody try to make that argument yet, which must mean that it's not a very good one. Okay, second, Intel v. Hamidi, the case of Mr. Hamidi sending these unwanted emails. How does Intel counter the speech it doesn't like? In the first instance, it tries the technical property route and just tries to block them. That fails. So it says, all right, I'm going to go to court. And what does it do? It doesn't invoke defamation law. It's not going about, hey, our rights are being violated not to be lied about or have bad things said about us, although it could try that. Of course, then you'd have to litigate the truth of Mr. Hamidi's claims, which perhaps Intel doesn't want to do. But the other thing it can do is go after property. This is where it says, not intellectual property, because it's not copying anything of theirs. It uses the second property category and says, guess what? His emails are landing on our server. And when they do, that is trespass upon the server. And the California Superior Court says, yep, you're right. It's trespass on your server. You have the right to tell him to get off your private property. That's then where property and speech finally completely butt heads. You have the unwanted speech, and in the case of the private entity, you have both Third Voice and Intel in those cases facing private means to block them. It's a little confusing because in one case, Third Voice is the defendant, and the second, Intel, is the plaintiff, but I hope you know what I mean. And then You also have the private entity claiming that the speech infringes IP. That's third voice, and that's using law. And you have the private entity claiming that speech takes place on private property. That's Intel. That's where third voice and Intel diverge in their invocation of private property through law as the means of fighting this speech that they don't like. So let's look at Intel's claim. We've already looked at third voice's claim through our panel. Intel says the private entity, as a private entity, the speech is taking place on my private property. Now, the way they're going to do it is through a chart a lot like this. You're going to get into the technical details of how electrons bounce around the internet. And at some point, they're going to make the argument that those electrons come onto Intel's server, and they are unwanted there. They are refugee electrons to be shipped off and to be dragged off by force if necessary, thanks to the government, because they've already been made, been told quite clearly, you are not wanted here. That's the way the trespass has worked. It's also how it has worked in the Cyber Promotions, the CompuServe case, where CompuServe said all of the spam coming from the king of spam, that's what his self-proclaimed name is, we don't want, it's trespass on our server, and the Ohio court says, you're right, it's trespass. We give an injunction against the guy and tell him not to send email to your server anymore. Now, Sunstein's answer to this, Cass Sunstein, for the MIT folks that did not have the benefit or burden of reading Cass Sunstein's article for today, Cass Sunstein says something like, I am made happier by a world in which not only the popular voices are heard, in which there is somehow a quality of argument, at least in the first instance, and you get a rich debate taking place. To the extent that that doesn't happen, I am less happy. Now, of course, that's not saying anything about legal entitlements. And the California Superior Court says, that might be right, Professor Sunstein, but show me where Hamidi has a right to trespass on Intel to give them the kind of speech that they don't want to hear. This is where Marsh v. Alabama comes in. Marsh v. Alabama is the case, again, I guess all the law students read. Did the MIT students read it too? All right, nice. This is the way cases ought to be. They're short, they're to the point, they're entertaining. Here is the city of Cambridge, courtesy of MapQuest. There is a lattice of roads and streets connecting everything together. I included both MIT and Harvard in this so as to be nominally neutral. And you'll note, if you think of this as a speech map, that private property and speech don't butt heads that much. Because all of the yellow places that are private and where people have a fairly undisputed right to toss people off their property because they don't like their speech are circled by all these gray lines. So great, throw me off the property, I'll just stand on the sidewalk. And you hold the sign and people entering and leaving the building have to see the message. This makes Cass Sunstein happy and it provides a natural architecture for speech to take place even when private actors don't want to hear it. Here is the town of Chickasaw. Chickasaw, Alabama, the suburb of Mobile that was the subject of Marsh v. Alabama. Chickasaw does not have as much of a lattice of streets. There's Route 43, the highway going through it. And here the street names from the very creative Gulf Shipbuilding Company, Gulf Shipbuilding, which owned Lock, Stock, and Barrel. The town of Chickasaw had title to the entire plot. And you can see they're very creatively named Pine Street, Oak Street, Hill Street, and there's Gulf Street after the company. And on the other side of the railroad tracks, as you get off of Route 43, the public byway, you can imagine Mrs. Marsh standing right at the intersection of Southern and Viaduct, handing out her stuff in front of the post office. She said, sorry, you're going to have to go to the other side of the tracks onto Route 43 and hand them out to passing logging trucks. She says, no, I think I have a right to be within this gray lattice. And what does the Supreme Court say? But yes, you do have that right. Somehow, when enough private property impinges on the public, when you have the absence of the lattice, the public lattice, the only lattice of streets you have is private, we are going to impose responsibilities on the private party as if they were the state. And why is that? Because the public has the same interest that it is our responsibility as the Supreme Court to vindicate in the open exchange of ideas, even unpopular ones, proximate to the people who are the target of the ideas. That's what Marshby, Alabama stands for. So what do we learn from this about the Internet? How would it shed light on Intel v. Hamidi? Now you can see I've taken my own artistic hand to PowerPoint. The yellow blocks with letters represent private lots, private parties. Mr. A, Ms. B, Dr. C each own their plots. And there in the middle is the road that you can drive down owned by the city. This is the Cambridge model. And with it, no matter who among A through J doesn't want to hear you, you can stand in the blue zone in the middle and wave your sign. You have a First Amendment right to do so, and any attempt to limit you has to pass a First Amendment test. Chickasaw looks exactly the same, except in the middle is the Gulf Shipbuilding Company, not the city. And the interesting twist that Marshby, Alabama does is it says, GSC equals city. So sorry, Gulf Shipbuilding, you've got to allow that on the street, even though you are a private actor, and perhaps even A through J are lessees of your land. All of this is GSC, but you must allow on the stuff that looks like roads that are proximate to that land, protest and speech to take place. So what does the Internet look like? What is the proper model here for the net? Now, I'm not so sure. I'm going to offer you a couple hypotheses. We have something called the cloud. Techie people talk about the Internet cloud. Isn't that like a fun place to be? Let's all go to the Internet cloud. The Internet cloud is the loose word for the networks that are the backbone, the stuff in the middle. Because the magic of the net, the way it is currently architected, is you ship your data, your packets that are labeled for some faraway destination, to the edge of your territory. You usher them to the edge of your network, and you pass them off to the cloud. And let the cloud worry about how the packet gets to where it's going. And when that happens, that means that somehow in the middle would be the space in which to protest. How do you protest near Intel.com? What would it mean to do so, to protest in front of it? And I don't know what the answer is, but it might mean something like Third Voice. It might mean some way of having your email get into employees at Intel.com all the way to their door and not simply allow a claim of private property to come through. Because indeed, the way the California Superior Court looks at the Internet, it says there is no highway. A's territory extends out into the middle of the road, so does F, so does G. There is no public road in the middle. All there is a series of private lots that happen to abut each other and that voluntarily pass packets like a fire brigade from one to the other that are due to reach some faraway destination. And in that instance, if you become unpopular enough, if Paul Dixie doesn't like you, that coordinated boycott means that if A, F, B, and G are not happy with you, you cannot get your packets down that road. In that instance, do they have some First Amendment responsibility to let you through? I don't know. That's a radical and difficult question to answer. But it's exactly this mixing of public and private, this ICANN-like middle, that is causing so much of the trouble. Yes, question?
I think the two cases you cite don't make the distinction, but it seems to me there's a distinction between Intel and CompuServe. CompuServe is acting like the public roadway, while Intel is being a business and dealing with its own employees.
That's true. CompuServe is simply acting on behalf of its customers, saying, we don't want all this stuff. Intel is saying, I am the customer, and I don't want this stuff. But of course, Intel is acting on behalf of its employees. Its employees, in turn, have email accounts. And then you want to say, what is the conception of having an email account at Intel.com? In a world in which email accounts were scarce, a world without Hotmail, would you think differently about what it means to have an email account at Intel.com than you would if it is a world in which, hey, these people can go get Intel, can get Hotmail accounts?
I think I would. It seems to me that employment law seems pretty clear that, I mean, by the time you put your lunch in your desk drawer, it's not clear you own it anymore. I mean, you don't have the right to stop the company from looking at it. I mean, the work environment seems clearly under the law controlled by work.
And why is that a world that is not intolerable to live in? Why is that an okay world?
Probably because you don't spend your entire life...
Right. You clock in and you clock out. And you have an entitlement to work somewhere else if you don't like it. And you have a union that can make some of the rules go away through collective boycott action. But in a world in which there's no sidewalk outside, you go from one employer to another private space that has its own rules about your lunch. And then you go home, and your home is actually rented by somebody that has rules about your lunch. Suddenly, you have no free lunch anywhere, not just at work. How? Time. I've been given the stopwatch, so let me leave you with that question and a blank screen. I'm out of slides. And with that, introduce Professor Sweeney to give the presentation. And do you need to be plugged in? Shall we plug you in? So why don't, Alex, why don't you help, which buys us time for one more question, if there is one. One more question. Sir.
It seems to me, currently the point is that the First Amendment claim was just as much a claim by the employees of Intel. The people who really are standing to bring the First Amendment claim are the employees of Intel, or in other cases, they're the ones with the First Amendment claim, not only for media, but it's not just the right to sort of just be able to speak, it's also, as you're saying, the right to just speak out there and to absorb it.
Yeah, I think that's right. Certainly the First Amendment is robust enough to count and to have cases under which you are free to speak, and you impose as a speaker with a message you want to give a First Amendment right to do so and to hear. And indeed, some of the cases are cases in which people have a First Amendment right to go door to door and knock on each door. And only after that first knock they're told go away do they have to go away. Now, whether that's for the benefit of the speaker or for the benefit of the listener who does, for whom there should not be a proxy of the municipality saying, we assume that nobody wants to get their door knocked upon, it's probably for both benefit. It's about the exchange of ideas between the two. I see now, Professor Sweeney, you are ready to roll.
Yeah.
So do you want a, can I give you a, okay.
So I'll introduce myself. I'm actually half at MIT, sort of, but my appointment is at CMU. I'm really a computer scientist by training, and I think the real question that I'll be posing to you is almost a question of, is technology sort of at war with privacy, in particular data sharing? The kind of, like I said, I'm a computer scientist, and the kind of work I do is really about computer systems that learn information about entities. Those entities might be people, they might be companies, they might be other countries. And so there's a duality to this work. On the one hand, they're about combining sort of these disparate pieces of information to be sort of a data detective. That is, how do I link information together that's publicly available and put profiles of individuals or companies and so forth together? On the other hand, if you're very good at being a data detective, then you have a really good idea of what it means to be a data protector. That is, how do you go about releasing information, whether it's the declassification of government documents or information that the government collected, like in the Census Bureau and wants to give it out, or what have you. How do you release information so that you can sort of control what can be learned about these entities? Or in particular, can you control their identities? So let me start by explaining that society has really gone under an explosion of person-specific information. A couple of years ago, in an attempt to sort of characterize this growth, I introduced a new metric called disk storage per person. And it's basically how much rigid disk space is available to store information on each adult in the world population. In 1983, I'll show you all the numbers, but just give you sort of a nutshell summary. In 1983, it meant if I took an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, I could record 2 months of your life on that piece of paper. But by 1996, on that same 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, I could use a piece of paper for every hour of your life. With 20 gigabyte drives leading the industry,
next year I would have a piece of paper to record every 3.5 minutes. And that clearly accounts for video the increase in video surveillance as well as biometric information. To give you a sense of how the growth has happened, these are numbers that come from some work I've done this summer in the Illinois Department of Public Health. Basically, in 1983, the state collected only, the numbers that you see here are characters, where a letter or what have you is a single character. In 1983, the kind of information you get on your birth certificate, which has about 15 fields of information, was the only thing they collected. Now almost every state in the union collects over almost 300 fields of information for every birth, and in some states like Massachusetts, almost 500 fields of information. That includes income and educational level of both parents, various lifestyles about lifestyle questions about the mother, and so forth, even though they still only give out the first 15 fields of information. In 1983, the state didn't collect anything on each on a visit to the hospital. But today, including Massachusetts and 36 other states, every time a person goes to the hospital, a copy of that information goes to the state. Many of us can relate sort of to the grocery store visit. In 1983, if you went to the grocery store and walked out, all they know is someone came in, this is the amount of money they spent, and this is how much tax they paid. Now if you go in and you use a discount card, they also know your identity, as well as every single piece of item that you purchase. I should tell you that one of the things that this curve correlates to, this explosion in information, is access to inexpensive computers with large storage capacities. And as technology has become more and more available, it's made it very easy to collect data and therefore disseminate it and share it. In presenting this information to you, the first part of the talk, the rest will be about the identifiability of data and our confusion with it in terms of our laws and practices. And then just a little bit of the technical issues of the privacy technical framework, and then why it's been so difficult or why it's, and some people say it's hopeless. The idea of anonymous data is really quite simple. It means that there's nothing I can do to that data to manipulate it or to link it in any way to an identifying individual. But if you read our policies, practices, and legislation, they talk in terms of de-identified data, meaning that that all explicit identifiers like name, address, and phone number have been removed or replaced with a made-up alternative. And what I'm going to show you is that this notion of de-identifying information provides absolutely no guarantee that the result is anonymous. Suppose I tell you that these three records are part of a very large and very diverse database. At first glance, you're going to say that these are anonymous. But if I subsequently tell you that 33171 is primarily a retirement community, then there are going to be very few people of such a young age living there. 02657 is the zip code for Provincetown, Massachusetts, and reportedly there are only 5 black women who live there year-round. 20612 may have only 1 Asian family. Notice that there was information outside this data that helped to re-identify these individuals. The National Association of Health Data Organizations reports that 37 states have legislative mandates to collect hospital-level data. So like I said before, each trip to the hospital, this is the kind of information that goes to the state. Zip code, birthday, gender, ethnicity code, visit date, diagnosis codes, procedures, and many states' medications, and so forth. The patient number in the early going was a Social Security number, and in more latter going has been this notion of a scrambled Social Security number. By scrambled Social Security number, I mean that the digits have been rearranged following a particular algorithm. So if I find my known Social Security number, then I automatically know how to descramble the digits and therefore can re-identify the Social Security numbers of everyone. The Group Insurance Commission here in Massachusetts a couple of years ago decided that they could improve their negotiations when they purchase insurance for state employees, families, and retirees if they got a copy of all the information that goes to the state. If they got similarly, they collected, and then they could figure out who was costing, how much the health care for state employees and so forth really were. This is a subset of the kinds of information the GIC collected. One of the things that I found is that once the data collected for one purpose immediately gets used for another. Within 3 months of collecting the data, GIC had already given copies away to researchers here at Harvard, BU, and so forth, and it also sold copies to industry, including a pharmaceutical company. For $20, I went to the city of Cambridge and purchased the Cambridge voter list. It came on 2 floppy diskettes. It included name, address, voting information, along with zip code, birth date, and gender. And I purchased the voter list because most municipalities make available, and we historically have, many kinds of population registers. It could be marriage license, divorce records, real estate holdings. It's hard to get driver's license information, but you can get the motor vehicles that are owned and so forth. You can see that you can take this believed to be anonymous medical data and link it to a population register, in this case, voter list, by zip code, birth date, and gender, to sort of take this believed to be anonymous data and sort of re-identify it. The question, of course, would be how unique would such a linking be? The Cambridge voter list is kind of interesting. It contained 54,805 voters. And even despite the fact that both MIT and Harvard are housed here, there was still a skew, in the, obviously a skew in the population to the early 20s. But even despite that, birth date alone, that meant month, day, and year of birth, uniquely identified 12% of the population. That means that those people happened to visit a website and just gave their birth date and what city they lived in, that they could still be identified by name and so forth. Birth date and gender, 29%. Birth date in a five-digit zip code, 69%. Birth date in the full postal code, 97%. Notice these are only one- and two-way combinations, not three-way and beyond. I chose Cambridge, Massachusetts, because William Weld was the governor of Massachusetts at the time I ran the study, and he lived here in Cambridge. Only six people had, and obviously he was in the GIC data because he was the governor, and so therefore the data that they collected were on all state employees, including judges and other legislators. Only six people had his birth date, only three of them were men, and he was the only one in his five-digit zip code. In addition to linking data, and I've done many experiments of linking data, there's also this idea of profiling data. That is, you take since there's so much data available, you just sort of take this data and you start, you just keep running lots of data through and just keep building up profiles. You may not know who the individual is, but you'll just keep getting more and more information. Oh, they bought something here. Oh, they have a car. Oh, they have this, they have that. Until eventually you'll get a name as well. So this notion of profiling is very interesting with respect to the web. Let me give you an example of one of my first profiling cases. It was actually under a law case where a Department of Public Health was being sued under the Freedom of Information Act to release information from a cancer registry. This was the kind of information that they were being asked to release, a column that would give you the type of cancer. This is the date of diagnosis, not the date of birth, but just the date of diagnosis, and the five-digit zip code in which the person lived. The court did not believe that the data were anonymous. The court believed that the data were anonymous and should be released. And so I had produced a document for the court that sort of did the statistical survey and just sort of said, well, actually, if you were to release this, if I were to do a reidentification experiment, for each of these records, I could probably give you 10 people's names, and among them, you would have to survey, and one of them would be the right person. So I get there, and the judge doesn't believe me and says, well, you got a laptop sitting there? In fact, it was that very laptop. You got a laptop sitting there? And I'll tell you what, I'll see you at the end of the day, and you show me what you have. And I'm sitting there, and I didn't come prepared at all. And in fact, the judge had chosen five names, and five individuals, and they were like this. Four of them were Kaposi sarcoma, and one was neuroblastoma, and said, okay, well, if you don't have that much time, then just find these. So I was left with only what I could find on the web or whatever little files or what have you that I had on the computer. It was really interesting. At the end of the 3.5 hours, I actually gave the judge one name for each of these cases and in some cases a social security number, and all five of them were correct. And this is made up information, so you can't repeat me. But it's pretty amazing. Also because Kaposi sarcoma found in young men is also, I knew their HIV status, so I also knew that they had AIDS. And neuroblastoma was interesting because it's a childhood cancer, and there's just not as much information available about children. Subsequently, the state decided, well, the question was, what form of the data could be released? And so I was asked, what would be the hardest to re-identify? And clearly, that would be the children, so neuroblastoma. Also, neuroblastoma is very difficult because there is no diagnosis code that is neuroblastoma. So if you have a heart attack, there's a diagnosis code that says heart attack, myocardial infarction. If you have leukemia, there's a diagnosis code. But there is no such code for neuroblastoma. It's a preponderance of care and and diagnoses that imply neuroblastoma. So it's a very interesting kind of cancer. It's also an environmental cancer, so it's one that finds its way in lawsuits often. And also they gave me, instead of month, day, and year first, just month and year, and then they still left the 5-digit zip code. I re-identified all of them, 100% of them, found all of the children, and that was also quite amazing. You might ask how this is done. And this, I know you have to pardon, this is not meant for you to read, just to give you a sense, actually to overwhelm you by how much information is available. And the way to think about these kinds of problems is you sort of say, well, what kind of information would I get about a child who had neuroblastoma? There's certainly birth information, and that would be evidenced by healthcare cost data, birth notices in the newspaper, insurance records, and so forth. The existence of the child will also show up in credit card purchases, grocery purchases for diapers and so forth, warranty cards on baby items, and so forth and so on. And so what you do is you identify which of these have publicly available data, and we simply use them for profiling. This is an example of how the neuroblastoma data was re-identified. I was explaining to the court that each of these nodes is a source of information, and there are many such sources at each node. Any path from the top of this tree down to a leaf is a re-identification experiment. So it's not just that there's one way, but there are many ways. This was very important because when I first did the GIC experiment, immediately the government responded with tighter regulations on voter lists, as if somehow by regulating voter lists it was going to stop this problem. The irony was when I went into the city of Cambridge that day, I actually went in to get the local census data, but the computer was down, so they gave me the voter list instead. So I wanted to make sure we didn't run into that problem here, and so I showed many ways. Another interesting example from this summer, actually, as well, was birth certificate data. The birth certificate database is not actually given out in any of the states. So this is information that the state collects, and they'll give you a copy of your birth certificate or someone in your immediate family, but they won't necessarily, they don't actually give it out to anyone else, not even researchers. What I did was I basically chose the city of Peoria, Illinois, and actually tried to say how much of the database could I reconstruct. And I actually reconstructed over the time period with 98% accuracy. This is an example of the kind of birth notices you find in both the printed press as well as more and more electronically. So it includes not only information that you would normally find in the birth record, but also information about other linkages to other family members. So you could also do interesting things like, say, you know, so you could play the game of how many degrees of separation in Peoria between people, because you could just say, well, who else is Mary Wilson come up on? And who else does Richard or Sally Smith appear on? That kind of thing. When I built the birth certificate database, the 98% accuracy is very interesting. Its correctness was 100%. The difference between correctness and accuracy has to do with multiple births. It was that I could give you three names, and I knew they were triplets, but I couldn't tell you which birth certificate belonged to which of these triplets. And so these were the 2% of students multiple births, and one case of an infant who had died, where I found them in the death database, but actually I didn't have a name for him. But I knew he had died. The kind of information that people put in email is just, especially on email, these are archives of email discussion groups, is just absolutely amazing. I've done a lot of profiling of individuals, not only how many degrees of separation between individuals, but just also, you know, that Frank and John are related because Frank's sister, Mary, went to school with, you know, with Peter's brother, that kind of thing, and you can show that these people are related, and all from web documents. There's also more and more pressure to, you might say, gee, why don't we just simply anonymize the data that we put in these archives? That is, that for everything, we find all of the names, the addresses, and so forth, and we just simply replace them with made-up alternatives. Wouldn't that do the job? And so that's actually how I started in this field. This is a sample of letters that At first glance, you don't think that that would be so difficult because you know, in fact, the patient's name. So you could say we could just search and replace and therefore anonymize it. But I also saw some very interesting things. For example, the name of the, a lot of typos, like instead of Dear Dr. Long, it's Dear Dr. Lang. A lot of nicknames where the nickname is not a direct derivative of the child's first name. References to other caretakers like Dr. Frank at other institutions. The mother's last name that isn't the same as the child's, and references and lower back pain notes and so forth to outside activities. And of course, you'd want to leave something like Lilly human insulin or Hodgkin's disease intact. So if you did straight search and replace, all you would get is what you see in the faint blue, leaving in place those things that you see in pink. I did come up with a system that would find both of them, and it did incredibly well, called a scrub system. And it was based on letters from Children's Hospital here in Boston. Despite the tremendous success of the scrub system, and it would actually do 100%, but it had a threshold. And as you asked it to be more confident, it would start scrubbing things like Lilly human insulin. And so therefore, I would get false positives and bring it down to the 98%. Despite the success of it, though, one day I realized, suppose I had something like this in the discharge note. At the age of 2, she was sexually molested. At the age of 3, she set fire to her home. At the age of 4, she stabbed her sister with scissors. At the age of 5, she ran away from home, or that kind of thing. Now, hopefully, there would only be, if there existed as an individual, there would only be one individual with that kind of record. But notice that there was nothing in there that required scrubbing. And that's when I realized that these attempts to scrub textual documents, for example, are missing the point completely, that it's all these details about you, that when these details are put together, they can be as identifying as a fingerprint, even if they don't have any explicit information about you. So what I'd like to do in the next few minutes is just give you a way to kind of think about the problem a little bit and show how that's been played out, say, in the medical privacy debate. One way to think about it is sort of to return back to Venn diagrams, to sort of say there's a population of people, in this case Dan, Dave, and Don, and Abe, and Al. And through some collection function or process, we end up with some privately held information about Ann, Abe, and Al. We decide to release the information, so we follow our practices, so we remove the explicit identifiers Ann to release the information. But there's external information in the world that allows me to re-identify the information that's sort of shown by the functions G1 and G2. One way to think about the problem of producing anonymous information is that what I have to do is be able to construct this function F so that I can make assertions about what can and can't be the case with G. So right away, most people start saying, well, what about, in fact, you see it in the legislation, and the proposed legislation. Encryption is the answer. I give a talk like this, next round of legislation, proposed legislation has encryption. So what would happen if we were to use encryption? And suppose we use very strong encryption so that you couldn't reverse that, and that the release also didn't have subsequent information associated with the encrypted value so that you could link. Then in fact, encryption is incredibly strong. It sort of, G sort of tells you it goes out to some pseudo-entity, like you know there's a person out there. But you have absolutely no notion of who that person could be. But on the other hand, I ask you, how useful is this data? Well, you don't have any type of demographic information at all. And so for the kinds of uses that the data are put to, it turns out that encryption, or for that matter, just suppress the value, turns out to be pretty useless. The statistical community has been looking at the problem of statistical disclosure control for well over 30 years. And they pretty much have been the people responsible at the federal agencies here of releasing public use information. And what they do, they have some interesting techniques. Some of their techniques is to sort of scramble the data. And that doesn't really work very well in today's data set, because what happens in today's data setting is that we pretty much want the information along the record to be truthful. And so when they scramble it, if this were medical data, then you get things like 10-year-old boy gives birth to 50-year-old woman. And so this doesn't help researchers come to any conclusions. The other kind of thing that the statistical community would do, because they were working with continuous variables like income and number of children, is they would take $10,000 out of someone's income here and add $5,000 here and add $5,000 there, or take two children out here and add two children there. Therefore, maintaining an overall aggregate statistic, but at the same time, reducing your ability to identify any individual. But again, that doesn't work in the case of like medical data or many of today's data sets. And the reason for that is that, gee, how do you sort of perturb lung cancer? And he has heart disease. You know, there's no notion of how you can take away and add in the same sense. This example is a technique where it's done the scrambling, but we left the information within the demographics consistent. So basically what happens is Al demographics get released with Ann's diagnosis. But then Al is a real person, so in fact it leaks back to Al. And even though we might say that this isn't real information, we scrambled and distorted this information, if all of the subjects had cancer, for example, I may not know what kind of cancer Al had, but I know that Al has cancer. The kinds of systems that have been recommended are systems where we want to release the information that's truthful, but we'll simply generalize the information so it's not specific. So we say that instead of the full birthday, we'll give you the birth year. Instead of the full 5-digit zip code, we'll give you the first 4 digits. Now it ambiguously links to multiple people. In fact, we can choose how many people it's guaranteed to minimally link to, and some of those people won't even lie inside of subjects, will be in the population as well. Sort of the idea that there is sort of anonymity in numbers. This idea of generalizing an attribute is really quite simple. You just simply, in the case of zip code, I just keep giving you less and less information, or in the case of ethnicity, I might just generalize the person. I do this because I just want to show you, give you a sense of what the data look like, and just show you one interesting trade-off that finds its way into the issue of the legislation. So suppose this is all there is to the sample data. Then what we might say is, here's a release using that generalization strategy where for every record that you see, for every row that you see, there are at least 2 occurrences, and so therefore the confusion is at least 2. The first row is achieved by keeping the ethnicity field the same, generalizing zip code by only releasing the first 4 digits. The second one achieves it by generalizing ethnicity. The third one achieves it by generalizing both ethnicity and zip code. And the last one does it by generalizing zip code by 2 levels. So right away I can tell you that if all 4 of these adhere to our standard of anonymity, then clearly these 2 on the right overly distort the data, and these 2 on the left are more specific, because these 2 retain more information, and this just messed the data up more than was necessary. So there's certainly a notion of a minimal generalization. But of these 2 minimals, notice I can't, suppose the person receiving the data is an epidemiologist who's trying to prove or disprove a hypothesis with respect to ethnicity and heart disease. And they would care very much to have the data on the left. On the other hand, maybe you have an epidemiologist that's trying to prove a particular cancer incidence in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They would care very much for the data in the second one. And notice I can't give out both because of collusion. And yet you want me to give out a public use file. So there's certainly a notion of preference between these information, and still the problem would exist even in perfect technical solution as to what do I do about the other epidemiologists. So these are 2 systems. This was one of the systems that I put out, used in HIV clinics often. Since this would be its solution on that data. You can see that birthday goes to the birth year, zip code to the first 4 digits, and one row has been blanked out completely. This is an offering from the European Union. Statistics Netherlands produced this. And this is their what they would have on the same data. Birthday again generalized to the birth year. And look at those beautiful zip codes. They didn't distort and they didn't remove it. They didn't remove a record like mine. And so about this, what happened actually was the Census Bureau knew that I was working at MIT on this problem and knew that the European Union had given $5 million to Statistics Netherlands. I was working only on the salary of a graduate student. And brought us 2 together. And we didn't know anything about each other. And it was very interesting to see how similar the systems were. But when you look at the New Argus system, the right above the yellow line, you see a white male born in 1964 and 02138. It turns out that kind of thing, I noticed right away, he could be as identifiable as the 5 black female we talked about in Provincetown, Massachusetts. That in fact, that they didn't actually adhere to a K anonymity, in this case of 2. And when I pointed this out to the Census Bureau, they ran an interesting test. They took 15,000 records, used New Argus at its best settings, gave it to the IRS, who re-identified all of them. So what this came to mean was that Dataflow, my system, clearly tends to over-distort information. It does more distortion than is necessary. The European Union system, New Argus, tends to under-protect the data. More recently, last year, I offered a solution that tends to find optimal results. It just doesn't work as fast. And and. I'll skip that number. Don't forget that. What that was trying to tell you is that what I've been doing recently is surveying public use files, in particular the medical ones from all these states that throw out all this public use medical data. And one of the things that I'm finding using that number that we just dashed through is that the data are 50% more distorted than is necessary. That means that the more I distort the data, like when we had those four tables, if I gave out the two on the right, it's not good for either epidemiologist. Well, the same thing is true here. If you over-distort the public use file, then it doesn't become useful for anyone, so everyone appeals to get the real stuff. At the same time, with all of this distortion, they were still totally inadequately protected. Even when they would do things like use 10-year ranges or aggregate information to the county level, I was still able to re-identify individuals. Okay, so let me sort of conclude on this so we have a few minutes for discussion by just sort of pointing it back to some of the policy implications and then a word about the medical legislation. Sometimes I call the first one the ACLU versus the ACLU. One of these days, the Freedom of Information Act versus privacy in this matter is just it keeps coming up. And for the most part, judges don't have the slightest idea of what anonymity means. So a good example has also been in the tobacco lawsuits, where, like here in Massachusetts, which I was involved in, where the request is made by the tobacco lawyers for the information about on what basis the state claimed that people were harmed, and wanting to provide the information to the other side, but saying the state saying that, yeah, but we want to provide this information, but we want to make sure that you can't identify anyone. And the judge sort of saying, well, I'll tell you what's anonymous. This looks anonymous to me. And so we're getting a lot of that throughout the country, and more we're finding that to be a problem. Another problem that I've encountered and debated is also law enforcement. So, for example, if you think about when I wear my hat as a data detective and I'm finding all this information, well, diagnosis codes, for example, in medical data is incredibly identifying. I mean, incredibly revealing and sensitive. So, for example, you could make a list in a public use file right away using diagnosis codes of people you're pretty sure use drugs, because the diagnosis codes will simply reveal that, and other kinds of incredible behavior. But suppose I work for law enforcement, what does it mean that I could actually go through this data or go through someone's financial information and tell you about their purchasing habits and so forth and without the use of a search warrant? You probably have talked already about the new intellectual property proposal where the idea that a database could, that if you do work to build a database, like I did taking the health data, linking it to the voter list, that somehow I should be rewarded for my work and therefore have some type of protection on the result. And then lastly, just to kind of give you a sense of the problems that the medical privacy legislation had or is having, is that of all of the bills that have been proposed, debated, discussed, worked around, early proposals, revisions, and so forth, if any one of them passed, they wouldn't solve any of the problems I just told you about. Everything that I've done, everything I just talked about, would still go on without any interference whatsoever. And one of the reasons is because they can't even describe what anonymous data means. They still say that, well, it means just take off the explicit identifiers. Or they also get confused, well, as long as you encrypt the data and you keep the key private, then the data will be anonymous, for example. And then there's also some of them that have a confusion that security is privacy. So they'll say, well, here are all the security protocols. You have to have the data. It has to be in a secured room. You know, only a certain number of people can have access. They have to have passwords. It can't be on the Internet, or it can be on the Internet, but it has to be behind a firewall. And so often the policies and so forth are really quite explicit. But those are all security measures. Just notice that in all the experiments that I was telling you about, I didn't break into anything. I was just using data that was given freely. And lastly, most of the legislation tends to model itself after the Privacy Act in the 70s, in which you try to identify who are all the people who should have the data, what are they going to use it for, and which pieces of data do they get. The problem is that keeps changing every month. And so it's just an incredible list until you just look. One time when I saw one list, it included MasterCard and Visa. It was sort of like as a group who absolutely had to have access to your medical information. So in having blurted through all of that, I guess we'll open up the Florida questions.
Yep, we have 6 minutes left. 6:04 by the authoritative trapezoidal clock. So, question. I have one question I wanted to start with. When you talk about security, we did a week in which we dwelt on the possibilities of so-called trusted systems.
Mm.
Systems by which, instead of just taking our old systems and hoping that we keep an eye on you so that you don't run out of the building with a disk, you can imagine from soup to nuts an ability to keep the data much more, in a much more refined way, know who's getting access to it, what they're doing with it, maybe even watermark it to them in a way that doesn't distort it for their purposes, but should they manage to copy it, could be traced back to them and then terrible penalties could result. Do you see that as a possible means of not having to release it the way FOIA releases it, but not having to keep it secret or fuzz it with the distortive mechanisms you have?
Well, you are fuzzing it if you use watermarks. So Ross Anderson, who's a big privacy advocate, he's a computer scientist and a privacy advocate in England. He and I actually were just meeting this past week, and we were talking about information hiding as a the relationship between information hiding and this type of work as a way to try to protect privacy. So first of all, if you add a watermark, you actually are distorting the data. The question is, you distort it in a way you could figure out who you gave the data to. The bandwidth for distorting the data, though, turns out to be pretty tiny compared to other types of data, so like video data or sound data. So that becomes, you know, I can put my watermark in it, but I got to give it out. So HIPAA has to give it out to 10,000 people or more. I don't have 10,000 watermarks, right? And then the other problem is, which also comes related to your question, is the issue of tracking the data. So, for example, a lot of legislation says, well, all we need are huge penalties and heavy sanctions. But how do you prove? On Monday morning, Citibank runs one of these data linkage profiling algorithms to find out who has terminal illness and then figure out who also owes them a lot of money on their credit card that has terminal illness, right? And then starts lowering your credit rating, right? Don't ask me if this is true. and so now, how would you prove this? Right? How do you go about proving this? And suppose you figure out that you lose your credit worthiness. Linowitz did a study in which 32% of Fortune 500 companies admitted to using health information to make hiring, firing, and promotion decisions. Well, other than Linowitz's survey, how do you prove that you're not getting promoted or you're getting kicked out? And so the problem with sanctions is that's really good if I could figure out how to get to identify how I'm being victimized and to get that trail back. Then in your system, suppose you give the data out. Hal's a respected member of the community. You give the data out to Hal with confidence. Hal gives it to me. I give it to him. Right? He gives it to three other of his buddies, and one of them turns out to work for Citibank.
Not
irrespective. And there's no way to show that. I had done an experiment with an MIT student where I had taken information that was made available on the web, and there was just a discussion about him. And then and just sort of sent out an email, do you know who this person is? And it was very non-identifying information, and he was so easily identified. So the reason I bring that up, is because even in very innocent conversation and so forth, even your attempts to watermark the data, I'll identify your watermarks, is also one of the problems too.
So do you see it as an inevitable trade-off, one in which we just have to take our best choice between privacy and the use of data for good ends?
Well, there are some places that don't have that choice. So, for example, the Department of Education, if they give out a public use file that I do one of these re-identification experiments, the person who works for the Department of Education goes to jail because it's against the law for them to do that. The Census Bureau would be out of business. That is, that they rely on the fact that you believe that they're not going to disclose your information, which is why you fill out the census form in the first place. So, and declassification of documents. Suppose the Department of Defense and National Security said, we're not giving out any more information because you could just figure out who everyone is, and so we're not going to give it out at all. It doesn't seem that that's even a remedy either to say, okay, well, there is no privacy because there's still many places in our society where we still have to solve the problem.
Everybody's just terrified. They don't want to say, I'm not going to be identified.
Yes, sir.
How many of these kind of techniques are used by folks like Kroll Associates and other private investigation firms?
I don't know how many are used by private investigation firms. What I do know is that there's an increasing number of data detectives sort of showing up on the Internet. So they advertise that if you give us $5, we'll build up a dossier linked with, you know, however many thousands of public records. So, and they use it as a way of, this is how you can screen your employees or new hires.
Just a quick question. Are there any other really scary things that are coming down the pipe 5 or 10 years from now? Like, if you look ahead 10 years from now, there's all this stuff that's existing that we're all frightened that exists. What's going to happen in 10 years to people more frightened?
Well, well, in 2 years, I would say video surveillance will be the big issue. There's an area sort of like government, sort of like Faneuil Hall is here in Boston, in Baltimore, along the ocean front there. And they installed something like 200 cameras or something like that. And, of course, crime went way down and so forth. But now they're taking that citywide. And I think that, and at the same time, there was a project at the Media Lab at MIT, for example, that given images of people would try to match them to your driver's license photo.
So the key is just to stop funding MIT. So it's the era of cheap sensors. I see one up there on the ceiling. I believe that's a camera in the newly renovated Thornburg Room. So everybody say hi to your future voyeurs. So, Professor Sweeney, thank you very much. The law students have a wonderful fly-out week, and the MIT students have a wonderful regular week next week, and we will meet you soon.
Thank you. Thank you.